Do we do an intro for Damien? He's here.
We'll do it.
And he's been on the podcast like more than a dozen times.
Yeah, I think you're probably, you must be the most appearing guest.
Yeah, I think
still.
I think I'm the original member of the Black Coffee Brigade, even though I put milk in my coffee.
I also had some milk in my coffee.
Yeah.
I think you're the only one who has.
I did it black.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't, right?
Well, maybe if Duff McKagan and Wade McNeil were here, they would drink black coffee too.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. The Black Coffee Brigade somehow has people in it who I've never met and probably would never be allowed to meet.
Well, okay, so let's.
I'm only allowed to meet Duff when he's with Danko. That's really. He's like, is Danko with you? Oh, the phone's breaking up.
Well,
you know, his real first name is Dunphy.
Dunfield.
Well, let's go to the intro. Let's go to the intro.
Dunfield McCaig. The Danko Jones Podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. Tell him for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes.
Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down. Hey, we're here. Damien, it's good for you to be back on after, what is it, 2 years?
It's been two years. Extended absence.
Jesus Christ.
Well, we've had very few ones where I've been around.
That's for various reasons. Yeah, more than one.
There was an issue that was addressed between the two of you, and now we've moved on.
Yeah, we beefed.
You beefed.
We had a bit of a beef.
It was a little bit like when E-40 confronted Notorious B.I.G. In San Francisco with guns drawn.
I
a bit like that.
Yeah. When there's beefs in wrestling podcasts, they normally get covered in other media sources. So I feel we need another media source to cover the beefs that happen in the music podcast world.
Well, this podcast gets written up a lot on, like, is it MetalSucks.com or one of those?
Yeah, and Brave Worlds.
Yeah, Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles, formerly. That's what it was
Brave
called.
Words, Bloody Knuckles.
So they've got to write about our... beefs, which are generally resolved through nonviolence.
But it was a year.
Was it a year? It wasn't a year.
It was a year. It was like 11 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
But now there's a new beef in Toronto. My new favorite beef in Toronto.
Oh, boy.
The Run-DMC Aerosmith-esque beef between Danko Jones and Sloan, as you guys are trying to write a new record.
Sloan and Danko fighting right now? Is that true?
In a practice phase.
Oh, do you share a space?
I have a feeling this is going to wind up on the cutting room floor, so maybe we should move on immediately.
I just want to say that, like, I like Patrick's Instagram posts.
I still think
Andrew Scott's.
The best line I heard from it the whole time, though, has been Chris texted you, I believe, is the story I heard, being like, hey, when are you guys going to be done? Sounds
great.
He texts
JC, doesn't text me.
But he said it was you, because then your line back to him was...
That was JC.
It's not Abbey Road, guys.
Yeah. Really? He texted him that?
Yeah, no, that's so JC. Funny.
That's JC.
Oh, he said you, so that's why I was like, that's the best line.
No, I can't take credit for that one. No, he's texting with JC. Like, JC's the one who's getting Chris's texts.
Okay.
And I just want to say that, like, now you've got me in a corner here. I just want to say that I love One Chord to Another. It's a great album.
Between the...
Andrew Scott is a really cool dude. He's really cool.
No, I'm hoping this leads to a Run-DMC Aerosmith-esque conclusion where you guys burst through the walls and do a song together.
But it would be Patrick in our space. No. Okay, anyways.
So wait, did Run-DMC and Aerosmith ever actually have beef?
Well, there's that story where they showed up for a recording session, and they were like, they're mixing the record, and they're like, okay, so when do we do shit? And they're like, oh, we don't need you guys. Like,
oh, Aerosmith.
We're just going to sample this. And Aerosmith was like all bummed out. But I don't know if that was a beef. I got my life threatened because of my podcast this year.
A pop wrestling?
No. Like, a guy threatened to kill me because a guest talked about him on the air.
Oh, no. I mean, do you want... Can you get into it further?
Well, no, because every time I mention this dude's name, someone finds it and sends it to him, and then I have to hear about it.
So, after the podcast... We won't talk about it.
And can I say that I almost got myself into a lot of hot water
earlier this year, slipping myself in the middle of a beef, and Damien,
the firefighter,
saved my ass. What was the beef? Oh, I can't say, I can't name names, but no.
it is an historic beef that would have had a new player introduced on the field.
Whoa! Hey, that's getting cut.
No,
that is a super cut.
I'm a smart guy. I'm a smart guy. I got intuition. I know stuff.
Damien basically saved me from a lot of headaches, and you know, me being very high strung naturally, I fuss over the smallest stuff, and this isn't small at all. So I would have had a nervous breakdown.
Put it this way. You're choking on a piece of food and I'm around, you're fucked. You can't breathe and I'm around, you might be fucked. You know, you're bleeding to death, I'm around, you might be fucked. But if you're about to insert yourself in a legendary music beef and I'm around,
right.
You are my saving angel.
I have refrained from a lot of things like that.
What are you talking about? You guys were like, this is where I learned beef.
Well,
from.
Yes, but I think that's
Holy
why.
Shit, I even had a beef with a couple of your outfits.
Yes.
Yeah. Over the years.
But I'm just saying, fuck. Because that happened early on, you know, then now it's all smiles and rainbows and ignoring people's pain or issues and just.
There was one time that some writer who is a friend of Nick's wrote some seriously questionable shit about my race in a magazine that's very popular. And I confronted him at the Elma Combo.
No.
No, I didn't even confront
him. I brought you together.
Nick brought us together, and he thought it would be hilarious if we met. And then he walked away and left his friend in front of me, and I just basically yelled at him.
Don't you think that was the right thing to do in a way?
Well, that's a very...
that was hilarious.
That's a very 2017 happening on the internet response to what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. I was way ahead of the time.
It's an IRL.
I mean, you want to talk throwing under the bus. I probably shouldn't even say this. But I was reminded of crazy things that had even happened within an old band of mine that were where I actually was a little bit of a good guy, which was like, I was like, oh... Well, I guess that's nice. I at least tried to make things okay.
I saw a show that Nick did at the Alma Combo. Look, he dressed up like Robin Black in front of Robin Black.
Right.
In front of him. And I was watching it, and I thought it was hilarious. And Robin Black asked me if Nick was making fun of him. And I just shrugged my shoulders, and I said, I don't know.
I've told Nick about this, how lucky he is, because...
Robin can kill you.
He'd kick my ass.
He would have gone on stage and done a roundhouse kick, and your head would have gone flying off.
But I don't know if that would have been good for his life. I mean, I will say, I'm glad he didn't ruin his life.
I'll tell you one thing.
Because I was goading him.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If I had found out back in the day that Robin Black was a legit shoot fighter... I would have been much more of a Robin Black fan.
I know. It would have kind of changed things, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God, yes.
He's like this hairdresser and like a great fighter. And, you know, to say I regret it is not quite true. Is like, I sort of wish we could all brutally roast each other and it would be fine.
That's a great idea for a podcast. Oh, I'd love to do that on this.
Brutal roast?
Like a roast.
Flanny's Roasters.
The problem is roast culture has become so horrific because of comedians. Like in LA, you know, there's a whole roast battle show. And
yeah, it's not the same.
You know,
I mean, when they brought it back, it was actually quite fun. But now it's really...
But Robin Black, it is funny seeing him now because he goes on Joe Rogan like occasionally.
Yeah, I'm not fucking with that dude or Joe Rogan. I'm not fucking with him. Whatever he says, that is the...
Joe Rogan, but I'm like, why is Joe Rogan... Why did he have like 6 months of having like all the same type of person on?
Okay.
It was like...
I don't want to start another beef. I don't want to beef with Joe Rogan.
Why are you doing this, Joe?
Oh, wait, I was bringing
him Joe. Up.
I will tell you one thing.
Why?
News radio.
Joe.
Top 10 TV show ever.
Can I say that too? I agree with you.
And Rogan was the standout.
He was fucking amazing on that show.
I mean, he was good on that show. He was funny. He was like definitely the What's it, the Matt LeBlanc of the crew?
No, I would say he's the Woody Harrelson of the crew.
Matt LeBlanc was the Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, but like
of the
Matt
crew.
LeBlanc hasn't evolved into that much of an interesting person.
Yo,
I'm not talking shit on Matt LeBlanc.
Oh, hey.
But like
he had that show where he's like, I'm Matt LeBlanc.
Joey, right?
No, Bullets or something, whatever.
Oh, yeah, that one with the British writers.
Honestly, yes. I get the two mixed up. Joe Rogan and Matt LeBlanc kind of look similar
but
to
like,
me.
But I'm saying, like, Joe Rogan, like Woody Harrelson, if you were a fan back then, who would guess that this goofy comic relief character on the sitcom would wind up being one of the more fascinating media figures?
Like, being the voice of libertarianism and contrarian what-ifs, you know?
I don't think it's all good things. I do wish that Joe Rogan was the old news radio Joe Rogan.
Who knew that the man who was on news radio would sort of be part of the pool that created such confusing feelings among the American public that there was a danger of the country collapsing, that he would be a small...
I wouldn't give him that much credit.
Made the pocket vag really popular, right? Is that what it's called?
And pocket pussy?
Fleshlight.
Yeah, yeah,
the fleshlight.
Fleshlight.
That's what it's called.
Fleshlight.
Yeah. Well,
he's done a lot for our culture.
I think the fleshlight would have probably done well either way. But no, I actually do like, I'm not even trying to slam Joe Rogan.
Do you think it would have done as well if it was Mark Maron hawking it?
Yeah. I feel like there probably is like a WTF. I think Maron's fault.
They're two different audiences.
The people who listen to WTF, a lot of depressives who are like,
that's true.
A lot of chronic masturbators.
I think any podcast that has anything that can give any level of pleasure on sale will appeal, because it's just like those. It's people who are like, you know what makes me happy? Listening to two people talk who I don't know for 3 hours. So let's just go over what's happening.
What are you roasting the audience?
We've almost named a lot of people who would get mad at us for naming them. I've insulted Joe Rogan
into a beef,
and now I just insulted anyone who listens to podcasts.
No, Robin Black is someone that I actually like, and I've now gone back and I've listened to Robin Black and the Intergalactic Rockstars, and I'm like, I dismissed this band out of hand too easily. No, there are like tracks on there where I'm like, a dude who is a shoot fighter singing these songs might be one of my top 10 Canadian band moments ever.
We had beef with the Intergalactic Rockstars back in the day. I don't know if we still have beef, but what I'm saying is, if we do have beef, I'm running away.
I think it's all squash now. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like I'm not going to face
that. I mean, it was
guy.
One of those things where, you know, and this is a very classic thing in the Canadian beef industry, is... like, nobody is really that bad.
There are some people
who are that bad. But a lot of it is, like, the people in the practice space over.
Yeah.
You know, or, like, too noisy. Or, you know, you don't like the cut of their jib. And then it's like, screw that guy. And it's like... They went to school like near you, whatever.
When some cocky writer for a local free weekly decides to write up the fact that you had beef with Billy Talent and start a whole war out of that.
Well, look, that's not my fault. That's I got a good quote.
You're in that. You're in.
He started
in
it.
That?
He started it.
You started that thing, Nick?
Yeah, I did. I think because. It was
you know, that bled over to me. That's why I didn't go up to... I didn't approach Damien. And I was shocked when he approached me.
I mean, you know, like, arguably, this falls at the feet of the bovine.
It does.
And this should really just be, like, sort of... This really should have been a fucked up bovine beef. I mean, this should be... There should be so much more beef with the bovine than really there is. And
no, wait, Daryl has been responsible for being the host venue for two of the best episodes of Turnout of Punk.
I know, Daryl, like, the bovine has been great.
Fat Mike and Joe Biafra were both interviewed in Daryl's living room.
The bovine, that's cool. Yeah, like, Daryl's employed me before. Like, he's, you know.
I have no beef with Daryl.
I don't actually have any anger with the bovine. I know we have to, like, basically take this out. They're going to, like, body check us, right? Aren't they all, like... body check type of people who like so you couldn't address the bovine because you know they're a mean hockey team group of people and so Billy Talent got, and I asked you for a quote.
It was Mike who gave you the quote.
I asked Mike for a quote I didn't. He could have said anything he wanted, and he said what he said, you know. And so I'm not responsible for people's quotes. And actually, my beef maker, it's not peacemaker thing, goes way back to. And I, again, this is like Toronto stuff. This is probably what happens all the time. On this podcast, so who knows how interesting this is to everyone. But when I had a zine when I was 13.
Holy shit, Nick.
Now it sounds like Turned Out a Punk.
Now it sounds like Turned Out a Punk. Well, I need a sec. Where's my second ep, bro?
We're going to do a second ep.
I mean, you have a lot of people.
Maybe if someone had picked up and moved to Los Angeles, they would be on a lot more podcasts.
Picked up is, I don't know if that's kind of too positive a way of putting it. So when I was 13, my friend and I had a zine called Free, and we interviewed the sort of Brandon Canning's old band Head, that Noah Mintz was also in, and Noah said in the interview, "Fuck this local guy, you know, he's a piece of shit." So we somehow printed this in our zine, and somehow it wound up in like iWeekly that there was this beef. So even then, we like stoked the fires of the aggression between these people. But I mean, I've been a lot better about that, you know, since. I don't know, yesterday, earlier today.
I had a friend in high school who stalked Noah Mintz.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, in retrospect now, looking at it as an adult, like, I'm like, oh, that was stalking behavior.
Right, right.
Well, that was, like, zines. Having a zine was basically, like, being like, oh, I'm a stalker. Like, I'm an obsessive stalker. And I'm, yeah, but now I want to document
it. But now you'd be like, I'm a journalist. Like,
yeah, exactly. Well, also they'd be like, I don't really do zines. I just like, you know, tweet or whatever, do a newsletter.
I do social media.
Yeah. Did you do a zine? I can never remember.
I did one that never came out that was used to get backstage passes to concerts. That we were already at.
Which is usually why people start zines.
Yeah, of course. Like, you want to meet the band.
You know what's one of the most wanted zines, probably, that I can think of? And do you have a copy of this? The Greg Turkington, as a teen, made a flipper zine.
No.
Oh, my God.
Flipper. Whoa. And he interviewed all the members separately, and I'm pretty sure. And, yeah, it was just a zine about Flipper. I mean, it was like 14 or 15. I find out a new thing about that guy. Anytime, like every time I talk to him or whatever, you know, he's but the zine about Flipper would be
a
big deal. And he like knew Will Shatter when he was a teenager and hung out with Flip. That was like his entry point into music and stuff. It was in punk, and he was singing. He was another guy
like Allison.
Like Allison,
Flipper Allison was Baker. That's her gateway with Flipper.
Allison is trying to write Laughing Hyena's liner notes right now.
Whoa. She's doing those reissues?
She's trying to write the Hard Times reissues.
Whoa.
Liner notes. And so that's exciting to me. And I actually re-listened
to that's
Hard
really
Times.
Cool.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It's really cool. And I'm really interested in seeing if the Laughing Hyena's will kind of get their due again, you know, because it's not like they didn't, but it's just... You know,
I was thinking about this, like, this is kind of on the same subject, but more about, you know, stuff that people internationally really care about, which is Toronto minutia. I would love to do a reissue label here. I was talking to you about this.
Yeah, you should. How Berger did some Bay Area reissues.
Yeah.
They actually reissued his Hello Kitty on Skates band. And,
really?
Yeah. They're 7-inch. And stuff like that would be really good. I mean, I was on Spotify the other week, and I was listening to Demix and Diodes, and I know that's like the more well-known stuff. Reissued. Yeah, that's been reissued.
My only problem with your reissue idea, if I was to go in on it with you, was I was thinking after, because I have so many beefs.
Yeah, but you don't have...
You wanted to do a band that I sort of had a beef with, there'd have to be a sit-down.
Yeah,
enough.
Yep. But this would be a great cleansing process for you to go through too.
Yeah,
you know, like this would be a chance for.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and I, like, let's be honest, like a lot of the people we have beefs with, we're not going to do reissues of their bands anyway. You know,
Well, okay, here's my question.
We'll do that Killer Elite box set.
The Killer Elite. I mean, okay,
that's what I was saying. The beef's over tomorrow.
The beef's over tomorrow.
Flans and Danko.
Yeah, Mike's together. Mike from Killer Elite will be there tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what he told me too. Yeah.
But it's all coming.
But actually, to Mike's credit, I'm not going to throw him under the bus here. But he did come up to me and apologize, and I accepted the apology. So
that's great.
Our beef was squashed years ago.
Years ago.
But anyway, like the problem with the reissue idea, if there is a problem, would be, I mean, are you not, you're not really talking about 80s or 70s bands, you're trying to say 90s reissues, aren't you?
I'm saying like whatever, the whole way, right? Through. I was thinking about this the other, I picked up this record by this band called Swedish Fish. They're from Toronto. Mm-hmm. Never heard of them. I got their second single yesterday. It sounds like Tallulah Gosh. It sounds like Scottish twee, but it's Canadian. It's awesome. And I'm like, you know what? How do I not know about this record? And I'm just thinking, there's so many records like that in every subsect of new music that came out of like the punk explosion, like metal. Obviously, metal came before, but like, you know, thrash metal and stuff like that. There's all these great bands that aren't reissued. There's all this like great demos that are lost. There's all these great things, and I think if you had a label like Flying Nun that had existed in Toronto, documenting the scene, it would have had a label, it would have had a brand, I think there would be more attention on it now.
You know, I think there's something to this, because it's like there's a slight clan kind of mentality with Toronto bands. So it's like, for instance, the 1990s local punk scene that I sort of stumbled into as one of the first musics I was really into, one of the first scenes I was going to shows at, they all had demo tapes. None of them had a label. They would never have thought about really getting it. They were probably Raw Energy Records was the only place they were really thinking of going. Maybe a couple, and most of them went up on Dead on the Road, but some didn't. And a lot of there were a couple of those demo tapes that were so raw that they actually sound pretty good, you know. And it's like, so instead of sort of sorting through that and picking out kind of the standout, which would be, what is it, Blunderman?
Well, like Blunderman, that's a good example, because Blunderman outside would be of Toronto, a good reissue. No one knows him.
I go in on that with you, Blunderman. That
demo.
I mean, the
demo's
not
incredible.
Not even the 10-inch.
The 10-inch is amazing, but that demo before the 10-inch is like...
But yeah, I think Blunderman would be the one to sort of, you know, is a great example of something to reissue. Yeah.
What about a compilation called Before the Scene of all the bands that went on to become Broken Social Scene?
I think that would be great, but ooh, you know, I'm going to let them deal with it.
I think there's a lot of
Bourbon Tabernacle Choir.
Right at this table, there's a lot of demos and bands that haven't come out or perceived their property.
Yeah, I can't really remember too many. So Brutal Knights had a CIUT performance that I think was like kind of interesting.
Yep, that was an awesome show.
We released under the politically inappropriate name.
Yep,
Radio Cum Shake, and.
So, Damien has been traveling the world. He's been kind of keeping me updated every so often about the one thing that has basically been his life for the last year, which is your Vice magazine, Vice wrestling TV show.
Yeah, it's called The Wrestlers, and it feels so weird to say that, like, I'm making a TV show about wrestling.
This is your dream job.
Yeah, it was kind of like it, and I've been in wrestling my whole life, but it wasn't until I started working with mutual friend and one of the greatest zine makers ever from Toronto, Glenn Salter.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, when I started working with Glenn at Full Blast, he would bring in tapes. And that's why
right.
Okay, I was really hoping you were going to say Glenn was like working on the show.
No.
I was so happy.
No, but then when I
got to bring him in. He's more he's better. By the way, people like Glenn Salter are more informed than fucking any of you people getting paid to write say it, Vice, you know?
Oh, it's like, anywhere.
Yeah, anywhere.
But that's life, you know? Right?
Yeah.
That's life in 2017.
That's life in 2017.
And there used to be outlets for these sort of people that just dive into the minutiae. But now those outlets don't really exist same way.
Subculture is being...
He's got a new zine. I was a teenage metalhead.
I saw. I'm so excited for that.
So awesome. He is the greatest zine maker of all time. But he also...
He is, actually.
He brought in a lot of these wrestling tapes, and he'd show me stuff, and I kind of started realizing, like, oh, I had been fed only McDonald's hamburgers my whole life because.
So, what era wrestling is he feeding you here?
Well, he was feeding me everything. I was watching stuff from the 70s. I was watching stuff from Japan in the 90s. I was watching current day pay per views.
So, he was showing you current pay per views?
He was showing everything. So I had seen
But this is in the... When was this?
Early 2000s, okay. mid-2000s.
Okay, okay.
So I was getting... I was kind of getting... You know, and I had watched during the Attitude Era, but I'm like, there's always something about the product that I was offered, WWE.
It's too clean, WCW, too sheeny.
Exactly.
I loved WWF Attitude.
I know. You've written some tribute songs to it in your career. I have them on colored vinyl.
I love DCW as well.
Oh, yeah.
That was obviously the thing where we went from like black and white to color, mm-hmm. you know.
And I had been exposed to ECW because a mutual friend of ours as well, Kai Boysen, mm-hmm. was a huge fan. And so I knew about ECW, but I don't think I'd really watched it like I did when Glenn would bring in these tapes.
Yeah.
And then it was like... Oh, wrestling isn't just McDonald's hamburgers. There's a whole world of hamburgers out there that are all different. Like some of them aren't even made with beef.
But it's all hamburgers.
It's all hamburgers. But what a world. What a world of amazing hamburgers, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and I think that's the thing is wrestling's like music is another form of hamburgers.
Yeah.
But we're never, well, no, some people are. But for most of us, you realize at a very early age, like, oh, there's all this other variety of music out there.
Yeah.
I don't really like what I'm being force fed.
Yeah, right.
But with wrestling, it's such a monoculture in North America, the wrestling, America and Canada, that wrestling product that we get.
That now.
That but ever since the consolidation.
Canada also did, though, have like a pretty, obviously we didn't have ECW, which was a big loss, but we had, you know, Lucha was viewable.
But we had Toronto was an NWA hub. Back when I was into Maple Leaf Wrestling on Channel 11 with Billy Red Lions, it was an NWA, and then sometimes for some reason crossed over to AWA hub.
I saw some AWA stuff.
Yeah, all the NWA wrestlers would come to Maple Leaf Gardens and wrestle. And to me, NWA is in the late 70s and early, all the way to the mid 80s, that to me is. I think that's the greatest era of wrestling.
It's a pretty amazing because Flair was like in full.
Flair
swing,
was in full.
Right?
Flair,
but he wasn't working the mid-Atlantic. No. Like, but still, I would buy all the wrestling magazines, and I knew who Flair was and Harley Race and Nick Bockwinkel, and you know, and then you get WWF on WUTV in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so you got WWF and
Saturday Night Main Event.
Stupid me. Because it was so sheeny and you know glamorous, WWF is what I wished Toronto to be.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm older, I'm like, man, we had the best. We had NWA.
Yeah, well, we were. Well, wasn't the guy from WWE like he was the Hamilton? Was
Jimmy
the
Valiant.
WWF,
Jimmy Valiant feuded here with the Kabuki, the Great Kabuki, and Gary Hart.
Who's the British guy? Oh, Jack Tunney.
He was the commissioner for a while, and then the president of WWF Canada. And there was also. Gosh, I can't remember his name now. I'm blanking on it, but he was like the guy.
The British who, Lord Alfred.
Hey. No, it's another guy. Like this guy who discovered Edge, and he was like the guy who would recommend like Val Venus, Sean Morley.
Oh,
And he was Bob, and he was Bret the Hitman Hart's manager. I'm just blanking on his name right now, but he became
Jimmy Hart,
the Canadian president. This was a shoot manager for Bret the Hitman Hart.
Oh, okay.
But that's what WWE did, and in that 70s and 80s period, or sorry, the 80s period when Vince McMahon Jr. took over.
Yeah.
That's where you had rock and wrestling, and he aimed it at the kids.
Yeah,
and he eroded the fan bases of all these organizations by hitting the kids and telling the kids, like, no, you want this. You don't want that.
Yeah.
And he did a great job, and he did that all over the world.
But he was lucky he had such a magnetic wrestler in Hulk Hogan.
Hogan,
hot because of
Piper.
Rocky III.
Yeah,
Roddy Piper was killer.
Hogan was essential to that work, you know.
He also had Macho Man.
He had Macho Man.
And he as well.
Junkyard Dog. Like,
you know, but he would also touch on.
With a chain, which was kind of.
You know,
odd,
were the Brainbusters in WWF at a time?
Yeah, that's where they came over. It's Arn Anderson.
So when
and
he,
Tully.
You know, it was a good move to bring over guys like that, you know, who had that pedigree or whatever. And you know, the heart, obviously the connection to the hearts is huge, and But it is true that he definitely simplified it, and it's hard not to think that, you know, I really do kind of relate WWF and WWE now to, like, kind of to Trump, you know? Kind of to, like, well, it's not... They seem like they have the same values.
Well, didn't he participate?
Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. Trump would not be president if it wasn't for his connection to the WWE. Donald Trump and Vince McMahon, their relationship goes back to WrestleMania 4 and 5 when he provided them the venues.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the argument that's been kind of laid out, and it's been kind of becoming almost like accepted truth in wrestling circles, is that if you look at Donald Trump prior to his appearance at WrestleMania, which was the highest grossing WrestleMania
ever. The one where he like got...
Where they shaved Vince McMahon's head.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Where that whole build up to that, that was Donald Trump's entree to his base. Because prior to that, he was definitely a celebrity, but he was a celebrity that would be written up in Spy magazine.
He was a New York celebrity.
A New York elite celebrity. Yeah. A celebrity of the elites.
Yeah.
And it's... Yeah. It was then that he learned how to deal with hostile crowds. Like my friend Court Bauer was a writer then. He was like, that's when he learned how to deal with a hostile crowd. That's when he learned how to cut a promo. That's where he learned how to talk to the people.
You could almost compare him to sort of that makes The Rock. Perfect sense. You know, The Rock was a heel and sort of was able to like just switch through just by fan. Not like I even want to give Trump that much credit, but a big issue, of course, is also that like, people don't really give him enough credit in terms of his knowledge of how to play people like a wrestler, you know, and that's definitely one of his skills, well, you know, as a person, is that he knows how to cut a promo. I guess, but then you watch the clip of him and he's just mumbling and saying words that don't mean anything.
Yeah, that's what the Ultimate Warrior did. And the Ultimate Warrior got over. No, but you both are familiar with the term kayfabe.
Yes.
Right? This concept in wrestling that what you're saying isn't the real reality as you know it.
Yes.
But it's the reality you want the audience to believe.
Yes.
That's politics.
Yeah. I mean, I do agree that I think that is an inherent issue with like when people are sort of going after the hyperbolic things that Trump always and has always said, is that it's, I think his base is sort of viewing that with kayfabe in mind, you know, a part of his base is. Because and then they're speaking like that, but it creates this horrible heightened world.
Yeah,
that is not what I want to live in.
And like you know, there have been now people are talking about The Rock running for president, but that's not that's not
going to happen.
Well, yeah, I really do think that
but
might.
Hogan said that too on talk shows.
But things have changed.
Yeah, now he's at $100 billion.
Yeah,
and also The Rock's been going back way back.
Like, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Things changed since back then. Like remember when Jesse the Body Ventura ran for governor and everyone was like laughing, but he won. Mm-hmm. There's a reason wrestlers make such great politicians and find it so easy to transition. Right. And that's not just in America. Right. Supreme Power Udi in Nigeria, Onita in Japan. There's a bunch of Japanese guys that have crossed over to politics. And I think it's just because these are the people with that skills. And I think The Rock, unlike Hogan, The Rock has been meticulous with his past. Like anyone you talk to, like you normally, you know, like in anything, like if you talk to some musicians about other people in music, they'll be like, oh, let me tell you about that guy behind the scenes. You hear that about Hogan. You'll hear like all sorts of crazy stories.
He's terrible.
And but The Rock get wiped from the WWE history.
Yeah, ever since he came out, ever since that sort of racist.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Ever since that racist rant came out, WWE.
And, I mean, think about how instrumental you know Hogan is, if not to the Trump ascendancy. Although I think there's clearly some sort of link to the removal of Gawker, which would have been this pretty vital thing during the time of that campaign. Mm-hmm. I really think because if you look at it, Gawker was what broke the Rod Ford story. It broke these humongous stories and it really, really followed them through and proved them to be true. And it was just so tawdry that it also made so many people mad who were like left leaning. So they were sad to see it go. Anyway, my point is that, you know, Hogan kind of totally sucks.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And I think The Rock has never fucked up like that. Like you talk Kevin Drew, who was a PA for the WWF back in the early 2000s, has a story about like running down the hall, crashing into The Rock and getting screamed at by a PA, but then The Rock being like, "Cool it," to the PA, helping Kevin up, being like, "Are you okay, man?" Like he was
That happened?
Yeah. Like back when Kevin was like 19 or 20 working as a PA, on these WWE commercials, WWF commercials at the time, I guess.
Yeah.
But he was that guy back then. He's
Rock
been,
also comes from like a wrestling dynasty.
Family. Yeah. And you know, I think
so. His dad was a fuck up from the story, so he didn't want to be like his dad.
Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas. They're one of my favorite tag teams of all time. Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas, amazing.
And The Rock also.
Rocky Johnson was amazing. Oh, Rock's Johnson, dad incredible. Was an amazing.
I mean,
wrestler.
I don't want to speak like that. He's an unimpeachable person, but you know, I do think the reason people loved, first of all, hating The Rock and then loving The Rock was because he was clearly putting so much effort into being funny and also to being a great wrestler, and he was really relishing it. And that enthusiasm just really was contagious. And he was just having so much fun with the crowd and including them. Like that was the weird thing about the Attitude Era was that it was, there were some people who became very, very good with massive crowds. Like it was Stone Cold was really great with crowds. And The Rock was great with crowds. And actually Kurt Angle got really good.
Kurt Angle was incredible.
And, you know, Mick Foley was quite good with, you know, in terms of promos and all that stuff. And so
my favorite promos, I've seen those guys cut promos. I think they're great. But my three favorite promo guys are Piper, Dusty Rhodes, and Ric Flair.
Yeah, that's pretty ultimate list. You know, you can't really.
I like Terry Funk. I like Terry Funk cried. I think that's and that's a huge influence on Onita, who would go on to start FMW in Japan.
Oh, because Terry Funk went to Japan, right?
He definitely went to Japan, but actually Onita did this crazy... Onita, to me, is one of the most important people in wrestling, because without Onita, there would be no FMW, and then it's arguable if there would be an ECW without FMW.
Right.
And without ECW, it's arguable whether or not you'd have Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah, yeah. Attitude might have never happened.
And Attitude might have never happened. We might not have seen The Rock.
Just had Bischoff, might have reigned supreme, because he was strangely... You know, WCW was kind of, you know, had that NWA... continuation thing.
The NWO had come in by that point, and he was like influenced by that's also taken from Japanese wrestling that he saw like this invasion angle and was like, this could work in America. But Onita was this guy, his father died when he was a teenager, so he went to Giant Baba, who's one of the godfathers of Japanese wrestling, who had just started All Japan Pro Wrestling, breaking away from Japanese professional wrestling, and he started his own promotion, and Onita was his first student. And so he trained Onita, and then Onita got sent to, you know, North America to have a tour to like wrestle all these different promotions and learn different skills. It's something they do in Japanese pro wrestling, and that's one of the reasons Japanese pro wrestling is kind of a cut above any other wrestling on earth, is because you know, it's one thing for you to train there and to learn their system, but it's another thing for you to actually go around the world and get experience working with different crowds.
Yeah,
and
that's still pretty amazing.
It still happens to this day. We were shooting in Nunavik, in northern part of what's known as Canada, Nunavik, and there was Kaito Kiyomiya, who's a Japanese pro wrestler from NOAH. And that was his first time ever leaving Japan. They sent him to the CWF out of Niagara, who does these tours around, you know, northern Canada.
The wrestling that must be so popular.
It's the only thing that comes to town. Yeah. Most of these communities. So you're dealing with communities of 500 people, 600 people.
They all go.
All the kids go. Cool. Every kid goes, and it means a lot.
Yeah,
and there's indigenous people wrestling on it, and it means a lot to see that.
That's pretty cool.
But this guy Kaito, this is what he was doing. He's a star in Japan, an up and coming star, one of the NOAH's big prospects. They think someone who's going to be a huge guy for them, so they shipped him to Canada to wrestle in these tiny communities in front of these kids that have no experience with Japanese pro wrestling, and he has to learn how to get over in front of that crowd. So the same thing happened to this guy, Onita, back in the day, and he refused to give up a belt in Puerto Rico, and five wrestlers beat the shit out of him, like destroyed him, and he went to Terry Funk's ranch to recover, and that's where he learned from Terry. Terry made him go around the ranch and set up barbed wire fences and
Karate Kid
style. But through that, he saw Terry Funk and took a lot from what Terry Funk did. And then he went to Memphis and saw what was happening in Memphis and took that. So he goes back to Japan, becomes a junior heavyweight star, but then breaks his leg, leaving the ring awkwardly, like doing some over the top rope kind of exit type thing.
Mm.
Just a matter of course type thing, breaks his leg, is forced into retirement by Giant Baba. And so he just kind of conceives this wrestling company that becomes FMW. But it's all through just this traveling around and sort of seeing the world. And it's really then through that kind of story that you see that wrestling is this kind of global thing.
Right.
And you can take a wrestler from Japan and put them in a ring with a wrestler from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them speaking the same language, never really having met just before their match. And they'll be able to kind of, through the language of wrestling, communicate enough
to do a match.
They'll do a match. And they'll entertain the crowd. And they'll convince the crowd on some level that what they're doing is more,
right,
quote unquote, real than they're actually doing it.
So this was the kind of thing you were learning as far back as
Glenn.
Glenn,
I've seen Glenn. Glenn would bring these tapes, and so I'd see Mexican wrestling, I'd see Japanese wrestling, and I'd see these guys interacting, and I'd be like, oh, wait, Hulk Hogan wrestled in Japan against this guy I've never heard of? Mm-hmm. And there's a stadium of 20,000 people there to see it, and Hulk Hogan's bleeding from the head?
Yeah.
Like, this is amazing. How did I not know this existed? Yeah. And that's when I kind of, I guess, fell in love with wrestling. Vice was like, we want to do these cannabis documentaries. I'm like, yep. I'm like, but there's this deathmatch wrestling tournament that happens every year in Delaware that we should really go film. And there's a guy getting out of prison this year named Nick Gage. Mm-hmm. And he's suffered injuries in these deathmatch tournaments, got addicted to opiates because of it, recovered from his addiction, and he's immediately getting out of prison and going back to wrestle for this organization and do one of these tournaments of death.
And you covered it in this upcoming show?
No, Vice was like, no, we don't want to do it.
Oh, shit.
It took 5 years for them eventually to be like, okay, here's a little bit of money. And I hooked up with this amazing director who's done a lot of incredible stuff for Vice, Shawnee Cohen. And we went down there to Delaware and filmed this documentary about this deathmatch wrestling tournament. And that's where that guy gets the Kenzan, the Japanese spiked disc that's Jesus used for flower Christ. Arrangements. He gets it hammered into his head.
Oh, fuck, man.
And so it ends up looking like a silly hat for the rest of the match because you kind of forget what it is that's stuck in his head. But then backstage, afterwards, to take it out, they need pliers, they need five people providing alternate weights to, you know, alternate pressures and stuff. God,
that's insane. Disgusting.
So I saw that, and that documentary did pretty well for Vice when we came back, and they were like, what would a TV show look like about wrestling? And so came up with this concept about what a TV show would look like, and once again, lucked out, got hooked up with two incredible directors out of Vancouver. And Jeff and Nathan kind of, you know, not being wrestling fans, like wrestling fans as they were kids, but like got on board really quick and realized, you know, this is a serious world and we got to treat it with respect.
So their curiosity was very strong.
Very strong, which is lucky because unlike music, like you fuck up backstage at a wrestling show, they will beat the shit out of you.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, what do you mean if you fuck up? Like,
fuck up in the match, like
not even a fuck in the match. I think if you're like there as an outsider and you fuck up in the backstage, like you start filming a luchador with his mask off.
Oh shit!
That, right, if you're a person with a
crew, just a lay person. Yeah, just a lay person
with a camera.
It's you're not allowed back there as a lay person. Right, like it's like music in a lot of ways,
right?
But it's very different than at least the music I came from, because in the music I came from and we all came from, it's all about, hey, you in the crowd, you can do this too. Why don't you start a band and get on stage and be just like us?
Right. Turns out not everybody had that mentality.
No, that's true. But in wrestling, it's the opposite.
Yeah,
it's like, hey, you in the crowd, don't do what we do.
Yeah.
It's too dangerous. You couldn't handle what we do.
Right. Well, it's almost like you keep telling people don't do this to really weed out who wants to do it.
And it's also just to make sure that no one
jumps off of the roof.
Also, people don't stop believing. No. You know, like you need them. You can't reveal the tricks. Like it's as much as it's it's like a stunt show with no second takes, no wire work, no stunt people.
Yeah.
And it's also like a magic show.
I mean, I was going to say, it's like a magic show with like real trick.
Where did you go?
We went to
crazy places, right?
Mexico, really off, Nunavik, Japan twice, Mexico twice, Mexico three times, Bolivia, the Democratic Republic of Congo,
wow,
and then just different parts of America.
Basically, that's not crazy. Madison Square Gardens.
No.
That's amazing.
No.
Yeah.
But
did you get some downtime?
I would get, like, traveling for this is so much different than traveling in a band. Like, you feel like you're actually grounded somewhere.
Right.
Like,
you have a hotel.
You have a hotel. And for someone who has an anxiety disorder, which I think a lot of lead singers have semblances of,
maybe,
too, you know?
Could be.
I'm not going to. I'm very public about
it's
mine.
It's possible that all three people had this.
But and which is funny because the least conducive environment to try and deal with your anxiety is an environment where you're traveling every day. You don't know what your next situation is going to be like.
Yeah,
you're that's why alone it's with your thoughts. What kind of person would want to hear two strangers that they don't know talk? Right. It's the type of person that's in a dead silent fucking van,
sure,
with nothing left to say with the other people they're in the van with. Like, that's why I fell in love with these wrestling podcasts. And I think it was...
What are your favorite wrestling podcasts?
Live Audio Wrestling.
Okay. Is that Dan...
Well, rest in peace, Live Audio Wrestling. Now it's post-wrestling. But it was Dan...
Yeah, Dan Levansky.
Dan Lemeth Lebransky. I don't agree with the politics of this show at all. And the language on it
is... But you like Daily Shower.
Which, no.
You're a big fan of the right stuff.
No. Keep It 100 with Conan and Disco Inferno. The biggest influence on me as far as why I started my podcast is The Art of Wrestling by Colt Cabana.
Oh, yeah. That's such a huge podcast.
Yeah, huge podcast.
And that's like his job now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's his full-time job. Wow. He was one of the first, too. I would say that certainly he's the first wrestling podcast, but I would put him in that original...
Timing of popular
20 podcasts that kind of like really took off and started kind of.
And they played a Teen Crud Combo song on it, thanks to you.
I
appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's nice.
They played our wrestling song.
Yeah, I've actually requested. that's been a long time that I requested that song before it eventually got played. Every time I talk to Colt, I'd be like, oh, yeah, for the song of the week, Suck It by Teen Crud Combo. And he's like, okay, every week. And then I got him to play Bad Skater by Five Knuckle Chuckle. Oh, no, Bob Backlund by Five Knuckle Chuckle.
Cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, by No Offense, when they were still called No Offense. But I was like, wow,
Where are they in the reissuable?
Charlie Horse, I would love to see a reissue of, which is their first record. I would
Maryland's,
love that on
where's
vinyl.
Where's Maryland's?
I would love to see a Maryland's Vitamins thing on vinyl. Like, they had those 2 7-inches that Simon Harvey put out. But, yeah, like, I love Colt's podcast. I love... Any sort of like Jericho, I listen to Jericho.
Stone Cold.
I listen to Stone Cold.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is at some point, the podcast just becomes part of a work, you know, like this sort of shtick stuff. Piper had a podcast.
Piper did have a podcast. And also another great one is Bruce Pritchard's podcast, Dude Love.
Brother Love?
Brother Love, sorry. Yeah. Dude Love.
Oh, cool. Brother I didn't know
Love.
He had one.
You got to hear that one. It's probably the most popular wrestling podcast. No, it's him and this guy, Conrad Thompson, who did Ric Flair's.
Wouldn't that be crazy if it was Brother Love?
Who did Ric Flair's podcast, and they'll just pick one topic. Edge, and they'll do a 5-hour podcast on Edge where they'll go through the entire career. And because Bruce Pritchard, in addition to being Brother Love, was Vince McMahon's right-hand man, he gives you a lot of cool insights.
I used to listen to Ric Flair's and Roddy Piper's podcasts.
Oh, then do you know Conrad Thompson?
Yeah, so I know who you're talking about, the co-host for Ric Flair.
Yeah, Ric Flair wrapped his up, and then Piper passed away.
And also Cornette has one, too, right?
Jim Cornette has one. Cornette...
That'd be interesting.
It's interesting. I've never listened to someone that I agree with more on 75% of the political stuff he talks about. Like, he's almost like a shock jock.
Yeah.
But for the Democrats.
Really?
Like the way he talks about...
Cornette.
Yeah, he's so hyperbolic.
He was such a heel, though.
Yeah, he's super...
He was a great heel. He was one of the great heel managers at the time.
I think so, too.
Yeah. But then he's got... then he talks about wrestling, and I'm like, not so hot.
Why is that?
Because he really thinks that wrestling should go back to what it was. And it's like trying to say music should go back to what it was. It's like
was it before? What do you mean? Like
where everyone thought it was
real?
Well, he talks about it like everyone always was just like it's real, and then someone flicked the switch, and they're like, oh, it's not. You know, it's like no, there are people the whole way through that didn't buy it 100%. And
oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just think.
And he thinks it's too flippy now and too exciting and too much like a video game. But the reality is the people that are consuming it now are people that were raised on video games.
ECW was so awesome because it was such a great mixture of so many different styles. And you would have those like insane Mike Awesome
Tanaka matches.
Yes, and at the same time you would have. I mean, I only went to one ECW event. It was November to Remember 99 or 2000, and so I saw Tanaka Awesome, and I saw a New Jack
match
where the crowd, he never got to the ring. He came out and Natural Born Killers starts playing the whole time through the match, and he was fighting. It wasn't the Balls Mahoney one. It was against someone similar, and he was chasing the guy around this basketball arena in Buffalo, and the crowd was literally following them through the arena. It was incredible, and eventually he jumped on top of a regulation sized basketball.
Damien, the specifics on your wrestling TV show.
It's called The Wrestlers, and it's coming out, I think, in April. We don't know for sure. Well, they probably know at Vice, but not me. And it's going to be on Viceland, I think, all over the place right away. I think it's going to be everywhere.
Cool. And look, I'm privy to some of the things that are going to be on the show because Damien's told me. And I just want everyone to know that some of the shit Damien's told me is fucking crazy. Like, on an absurd level.
Wow.
With some of the people that he was in the same room with, not even from the wrestling world.
I've actually heard some crazy things about wrestling, maybe in Japan, but I've heard a lot of things about, like, in-ring kind of, like, sodomizations done and like.
Well, like, are you talking like shoot ones, like ribbing stuff?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, I'm sure that's happened, definitely. Yeah. But like in
my friend Mike, you know, told me about seeing that.
One wrestler we covered is this wrestler out of Japan, Dan Shakudino. Dan Shakudino is introduced to the audience every time as an aggressive gay man. That's what the announcers
will. Oh, really? God. That's his character.
But when you talk to him, he identifies himself as a gay wrestler. So a lot of people have been like, oh, he's not actually gay. He's making fun of gay people.
Right.
Some people have been like, no, he is gay. He never, ever, ever drops that he's a gay wrestler. So as far as he presents himself, he is a gay wrestler. What he does in the ring could be considered incredibly offensive. But if he's a gay man choosing to represent himself that way,
right.
You know, so it's really a complicated guy to look into.
Very tricky.
Yeah, that is tricky.
We don't really, we're not able to come to any conclusions in this show, but he is a fascinating wrestler, and he's become a bit of a viral sensation because he was the receiver of the infamous Joey Ryan dick flip, which has become a widely circulated clip on Facebook and on Tosh.0 type shows, where this wrestler, Joey Ryan, has a super-powered penis that he can use to flip his opponents.
Oh, I've seen that clip.
Yeah, yeah. And the first guy to ever take it was Dan Shakudino.
I've actually seen that on someone's Facebook feed or something like that,
and
or Twitter.
To make it more complicated, the audience that goes to see him wrestle is for this organization called DDT, Dramatic Dream Team Wrestling. The audience is around 70% women for these shows.
What?
Yeah. And it's not, and it's women like office women, office workers, right?
How do you even get that demographic into a wrestling?
Wrestling in Japan.
Japan.
Yeah.
Oh, Japan. I see.
Wrestling in Japan has different organizations, and different organizations have cater super specifically to their fan base.
Yeah. Right.
So DDT, it's a lot of very attractive men who are really ripped. Mm-hmm. But there's also this thing in, I guess, like a cultural, a narrative motif in Japan called yaoi.
Is that the comic book thing, too?
It's in manga. Yeah, it's in anime. And yaoi is boy love, is what it translates to. And it's erotica targeted towards straight women that deals with gay men falling in love. And unrequited love, a lot of times, or forbidden love is reoccurring themes. And when you watch DDT, you're like, oh, they play on this. Like, that's one of the motifs they kind of use.
Interesting.
And, you know, and they also use Japanese ghost story motifs. They use a lot of stuff.
Kiyonishis.
Yeah. Well, like, I didn't really understand until I got there. and started, you know, hearing about these other larger cultural things that exist in Japan.
Yeah.
And then when I was watching this wrestling, I'm like, okay, well, this makes a lot more sense in a Japanese context. I'm not saying it's not still offensive to people watching it.
How does it compare to what's his name? The guy who died in the 80s.
Gorgeous George?
No. The other guy who was like Italian looking and sort of he almost had a Dino Bravo vibe, but he wore like makeup and stoles.
Oh, Adrian Adonis.
It's
right. But there's a few of those kinds of guys.
Dusty Rhodes was borderline like that.
Exotic Adrian Street.
Yeah. And there's you know, the way he presents himself though is he's just like he describes himself as a bear. So he'll just come out to the ring. Right. He's kind of portly. He's certainly not, because the other big thing in Japanese wrestling, especially in DDT, are these sort of ripped super sports Adonises that can have these 45-minute long crazy matches.
Yeah.
And that's in DDT too.
Uh-huh.
But he was like, no, I realized that my niche is to be a gay wrestler, to be a bear wrestler. And that's what I do. And so he doesn't wear makeup. He never like presents himself in drag or anything like that. He's just presented himself as a gay wrestler.
Right.
So it's slightly more respectful than some of the past wrestling gimmicks in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But the sexual violence, because it's simulated rape at sometimes in the ring that he's doing to guys. That's offensive. So it's this very complicated,
pretty amazing super, that it has gone that far.
Well, in Mexico, there's exoticos. And exoticos was originally a type of wrestler that they would use to make fun of gay men or men with effeminate traits.
Uh-huh.
And it would be a wrestler who would be very over-the-top flamboyant in how they would present themselves as gay. Normally, they would have been a straight man. Around the late 70s, in the 80s, and throughout the 90s, that space was fought for and kind of taken over by gay men that wanted
actual gay men
that wanted to
wrestling.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then not to say that there weren't gay men wrestling prior to that and in different areas of wrestling or even as exoticos, but they wouldn't present themselves as gay outside of the ring, or they would present themselves as gay to a closed off circuit of friends. But these wrestlers were like, no, I'm gay. I want to be
totally
gay.
I'm
going to present myself as gay. Right. And it's Pimpinella, Cassandra.
Pimpinella.
Pimpy. Pimpernella. Pimpernella is incredible. Pimpernella Escarlata and Polvo Estrella and Cassandro. Like these
Cassandro.
These men fought and got space as exoticos.
Wow.
But now we're at a point where people are like, well, is this still good? Because it's kind of, well, first of all, it's ghettoizing wrestlers. Like if you're a gay wrestler, you wrestle as an exotico if you're out.
Oh, I see.
And also, a lot of what they do in the ring comes from a fear of homosexuality, right? Oh, like it's, you know,
it comes close to the force violation thing that's discussed in the other one.
Yeah, like it's like a lot of force kissing of an opponent, a lot of ass grab and things like that. And to even complicate it even further, there's a new wrestler named Estrella Divina, and she's 6'4", gorgeous. An incredibly gifted wrestler. She's the first exotico signed to a major company because she's forced to wrestle in an exotico. They won't let her wrestle as a luchadora who's transitioned. So she transitioned a few years ago, and they still force her. She's forced to dress with the men. So
more
she's,
problems.
She's assaulted by the men while she gets dressed. She's not allowed to dress with the women. And she's kind of relegated to wrestle as an exotico because that's what she's viewed as by the wrestling company. She's not an exotico. She's a luchadora.
Right.
But this is where she has to have her space. But this is also the only place where she's ever felt comfortable, you know, in this ring. And this is where she feels powerful is by being in this ring. And this is what she's always wanted to do. So she's happy to wrestle anywhere she can. Would she prefer to be a luchadora or be called a luchadora? Absolutely. But if she can only be an exotico, she will be an exotico as long as she can wrestle
so
in the ring.
So that would be... I mean, it's just begging for a season two.
That's episode 3 of this season.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So you have 2 seasons already in the can?
We have 10 episodes done for the one season. It's one season. Okay. So it's looking at, exotico. So the first episode is about wrestlers that live. This isn't the order they're going to be aired in, but there's one episode about wrestlers that live along the Mexican-American border,
uh-huh.
and just how their lives have changed in recent years with the retreat of narco violence, but the sort of counter effect of the Trump administration and immigration reform looming over them, and how that sort of talk, that rhetoric, is having real ramifications already for some of these wrestlers. And the economics of Lucha Libre, like if you're a Mexican wrestler, you really don't make money, real money, till you come to America. But you can make enough money that you could support your whole family. And when you're talking about people that are coming out of complete poverty, it's a huge thing. There's an episode in America where we go along the East Coast and kind of talk about independent wrestling in America. Then there's the one with dealing with Exoticos in Mexico, one in Nunavik looking at a wrestling organization, CWF, that goes to different indigenous First Nations communities, all in Nunavik and northern Quebec. And then there's the one in Bolivia about the fighting Cholitas, which is awesome, too.
A lot that of sounds cool.
Japan, two in Japan, about one about DDT, that organization, one about
I have a
Joshi.
Feeling this is going to be a good
Yeah,
good
it sounds
series,
awesome.
Dude.
I lucked out. I really lucked out.
Yeah.
I'm with two amazing filmmakers that got it real quickly, and watching it now, I'm like, they captured what I experienced. Like how, like when I go back through my memories of what I was there for, most of it's there. Like 99% of it's on.
It sounds like it's episode. Almost like those noisy episodes about Atlanta or Bompton and stuff, but it's just wrestling. It's like, you know.
Well, we're in a really cool period for wrestling. Like, this is the period rock and roll was in just prior to Nirvana exploding, or film was in just before Reservoir Dogs.
So we're in the 1989 of wrestling?
Yeah, definitely. Like, wrestling's about to... Cool. We're witnessing a transformation where wrestling's going from a sport to an art form. And obviously, it's always been a sport and an art form, but I think people's perceptions of it is they can't get over the fact that it, even though... We've already established everything's fake, but people can't get over the fact that wrestling isn't a quote unquote real sport, but it's like, it's the most athletic art form on earth. Like these guys are doing art, but there's real risk. Like I've seen five people that we've been filming with, two people we filmed with have died since we started filming a year ago. And three people we have lost their career.
Wow!
Because of in-ring injuries.
Wow!
So it's brutal. It is real.
That you know that if anything, that's the one thing that kind of like keeps me away from wrestling a bit is just like the pain aspect. It just feels like.
Yeah, it's too real.
It's
now.
It's too real.
Yeah. Even though it's
as this, like when Mike Awesome, the story of Mike Awesome like breaks my heart. You know, and like or Benoit, obviously. I mean, that was kind of like the breaking point for me with wrestling.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
This has been awesome.
It's been awesome.
Yeah. I love any time that I can come back to the Black Coffee Brigade and sit down and have a chat because you are two of my favorite people to get to talk to.
I love talking to
two of the only non-assholes in the music industry.
Apparently so.
So
I love that I'm not in the music industry pretty much.
You can't deny the fact that you are in one of the most legendary bands, this shitberg that Rob Ford reigned over as king ever
and
produced.
And that was... Killer Combo.
I don't know. I love Killer Elite and I love Brutal Knights, but Teen Cred Combo.
Teen Cred Combo is
well,
a
I
great
mean, look,
band.
You two guys have contributed so much to the Toronto scene, and you had a band that basically became went from punk band to sort of like. Mural, like musical mural.
Yeah, we're mural rock now.
That's a great term.
That's pretty cool.
I understand
you know
what that
what
means.
Saying,
though.
Yeah.
All right. That's our, there comes. Those are the first calls to angry calls about the beefs we started.
All right. Well, it's been really great talking to you here uninterruptedly,
Damien. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me. Suck it, watch it as we go down low.
words for ya.